Now, welcome back to the introduction to modern cryptography. After we had a bunch of warm-up sessions during the last weeks, looking at theoretical building blocks, trying to understand how they can be instantiated, we will today look at something more practical. We will look at encryption. So the last weeks can basically be considered as understanding how the building blocks for encryption can be built. So we had pseudorandom generators and how they can be built. We had pseudorandom functions and how they can be built. And we had some initial definitions for pseudorandom permutations. We didn't have a construction for pseudorandom permutations yet. And this will be the first part today. And in order to do that, we first have to have a definition of security for pseudorandom permutations. And this is what we will continue here. So this is just basically copied from the end of last week. Nothing new here. So the first start is building pseudorandom permutations with the so-called Feistel network. The second part is, again, a bit theoretic, just to see, or just to let you see these theoretic results. So we can build encryption with the so-called one-time pad. And we can use pseudorandom generators to build very weak encryption that is not super useful or meaningful. But it's just a theoretic result that we can keep in mind in order to then think about how we can build a stream cipher. So a stream cipher can be built with pseudorandom functions. And then at the very end of today's lecture, depending on how far we come, we will look at block modes of operations. So modes of operations that use block ciphers. And a block cipher is basically just a different word for a strong pseudorandom permutation. So we will see that these modes of operations, they will leverage the security or use the security that a block cipher gives us to build practically useful encryption schemes, symmetric encryption schemes. But before we do that, we first have to build pseudorandom permutations, as I said. So, pseudorandom permutations, these are the pages in the Katz-Lindell book that you can use for getting more information about them. And pseudorandom permutations are bijections. And we have the bijection that takes as input a key, some value x, and outputs another element from that set X, from that space X. And we have the inverting function that also takes a key and then inverts back this element X to another value or to another element in that space X. The correctness definition, there was a long discussion last week about how to define or how to notate what correctness means. Maybe to conclude this discussion, there might be very many different ways of defining what correctness of a bijection is or how to define that. But just to keep it consistent with the rest of this lecture and the rest of the cryptographic literature, we typically define correctness as a probability term. Here, the probability is just one, which basically means that we have a bijection and we can invert all operations with that bijection, but there are situations in which we might have constructions that do not have perfect correctness, which might be uncomfortable, but this is the best that we can hope for, especially when we then look at lattice-based post-quantum secure constructions of public key encryption. In this case, we just look at symmetric encryption, or first of all, at pseudorandom permutations. So, we have seen last week various ways of defining security, and this is the first step that we do now. So, security of pseudorandom permutations is just as we're used to, defined as a game. And we call this game SIND. The S stands for strong. And we will see what the difference between the version without the S and the version with the S is in a couple of seconds. So either strong indistinguishability or normal indistinguishability of a pseudo-random permutation. This is again indexed with a challenge bit B. And another parameter is the adversary that plays in this game. This game starts with initiating an array Q, and at all indices, the value of this array is just initialized with this bottom symbol. Then we sample the input key of our pseudorandom permutation. We invoke the attacker that can then, in a couple of seconds, query the oracles that we define in a couple of seconds. And this adversary is probabilistic and outputs some guess bit B prime. And our game stops with the return value being that output by our attacker. Now we have an oracle challenge. And this challenge oracle gets as input values x. And internally, this oracle starts with evaluating our pseudorandom permutation. On input of the key that we sampled at the beginning, and this input value x. Now our challenge, as for pseudorandom functions and pseudorandom generators, is that this output value y0 should look random. It should look indistinguishable from a random value sampled from the output space. So we check if we have seen this this input before, because this is a function. If we evaluate this function twice, then the output will be this twice on the same input, the output will be the same. So in order to make sure that we can simulate this challenge, we have our array Q, and we check if we already filled this array on input X with something. If we didn't see this input yet, we will sample some output. And we will sample this output from the full input-output space, x, except for all the values that have been assigned already. So we sample the element that we want to output here from all possible outputs except those for which there is already an x, such that the value that we output here, that we want to output here, has been output before on that different value x. So we should maybe, to make sure and that there is no confusion, we call these x's here x prime. Yes, please.
Would it be okay if you quickly summarize on the sheet, like so?
What does that mean?
On the sheet, so if you look at it again, then it's mostly quite hard to understand what.
I should write down what that means.
Words.
Sure. Sure. So we sample from the output space except those values that were assigned before. You're welcome. So after we did that, we set y1 to q of x. And we just return yb. Then we provide a second challenge oracle. And this second challenge oracle is just doing exactly the same except for the inversion function. So we evaluate the inversion of the pseudorandom function on input of the key and the input value y. And then we check if there exists no x such that q of x equals y, then we sample such an x from the space of all inputs x for calligraphic x, but we exclude from that all values x prime such that q of x prime was assigned already. And then we set q of x to y. And we set x1 to x such that q of x equals y. And we return xb. And this second part here is only permitted to attackers against strong indistinguishability. Yes.
If there does not exist an x such that q of x equals y, and then you mean the assignment below is part of the int?
No, yes.
How to read this?
Thank you. Yeah, there are two different columns. Yes, the first one is such that, and the second one is then execute the following.
If there does not exist an x,
then do the following. Yes. So this here is. You're welcome.
And then goes far down.
Yes. Yes. Everything that is aligned is part of the then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, to help you with interpreting what is going on here, the attacker has two oracles. And these oracles give the attacker access to querying the internal pseudorandom permutation on input of the k with the normal pseudorandom permutation and with the inversion function. Whenever this is done, the attacker either sees the real output of the pseudorandom permutation or its inversion function, or it sees a random value for that. Important here is that the attacker, when it sees a random value, should always see the same random value when asking those things. And also, these things should be consistent. So if I ask the challenge with the real pseudorandom permutation on input X and I see some input output Y, then I ask the challenge oracle for the inversion with the exact same output Y, then of course I want to get back the input X, because that's the correctness guarantee that my pseudorandom permutation gives me. For that reason, we have this array Q here that traces how X and Y belong together. Now, in order to make a real challenge out of that, whenever we output a random output, we have to sample that output first. And for that reason, we have to sample from the space that is still available. So whenever something was fixed by the game, because it was sampled before, I can't reuse it again. So if I input if the attacker inputs value X to the normal challenge oracle, and then I output Y, and then I input another value X to the challenge oracle, I can't output the same Y again. Due to the guarantees of a bijection, if I have two times the same output on different inputs, then I can't invert one of these two outputs to the original input anymore, as an intuition. And that's basically the bookkeeping that we have here. All of this is just bookkeeping and sampling random values. The guarantee is that this pseudorandom permutation, if it is a normal pseudorandom permutation, behaves as a random permutation when I input input X to the pseudorandom permutation. So whenever I evaluate my pseudorandom permutation in the normal direction, I will always see random values but never repeating values, so I never see collisions. And a strong pseudorandom permutation behaves as a random permutation in both directions. So independent of whether I execute it in the normal direction or I invert my permutation. Okay, is that clear? Right, question.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what you mean by the game, the third line. There is a B prime, and then we sample from...
No, we don't sample. No. This just indicates that the adversary is probabilistic. So whenever this is overloaded, arrow dollar means either uniformly sampling from random or executing a probabilistic algorithm.
Oh, okay. So the result is not always the same when we call...
Yes,
okay.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So we allow the adversary to internally sample some random strings or whatever. The adversary is not deterministic.
Okay. So the arrangement is basically we have the game and then we have the adversary, and the adversary
can query all the oracles however it wants to.
And can communicate back to the game.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, right.
So the adversary is started at that point. At that point, it gets access to all these oracles. And whenever the adversary is done with querying all these oracles and doing some internal black box computations, then it will say, OK, this is my output bit B prime.
Okay.
Yeah, this is the idea. So you can just think of this as the boxes. So the attacker here is woken up or invoked by the reduction or by the game, by whoever. Then it has these arrows which indicate that there are some oracles, and then at the end it terminates by producing some output. And this is just the pseudocode specification of that.
Right.
Yes, please.
One thing I didn't understand, this thing is called pseudo-random
permutation. Yes.
Now take away the pseudo, it would be a true random permutation.
Exactly.
But where is the difference? Establish that it is a pseudorandom. What does that mean in this case? Does
yeah.
that mean it iterating again yields the same result? Or what is the pseudo part of it?
So a real random permutation would be sampled from all possible random or from all random permutations, and it is impossible for an attacker to identify it as a random permutation because it's just sampled from all possible ones. A pseudorandom permutation is indexed by a key, and the key space is limited. So a brute force adversary that has unlimited amount of time to compute things can identify a pseudorandom permutation as a pseudorandom permutation. So this is basically just the difference between, do I consider computationally bounded adversaries, or do I allow for perfect security in the sense that we offer security even for unbounded adversaries?
If you input the same key,
yes,
you get the same result.
Exactly. Yes, so if I get the same key, if I use this, so it's all these functions are, so all these permutation evaluations here are deterministic. So if I input the same key and the same X, I will get the same Y.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there is no physical randomness involved there?
No, not at all. The only randomness just only comes from from the key. Everything else is defined by the attacker. Okay, now we want to build this thing. So how to build a pseudorandom permutation? And to build this, we use the so-called Feistel network. It was developed by Feistel and published at, I believe it's crypto, but I'm not sure what the CP that I just noted here means. In 1973. But also important to mention is that Luby and Rakov proved that the Feistel network actually provides a pseudorandom permutation. In the Journal on Computing in 1988. And you can read more about this in the Katz-Lindell book on pages 226 and following, and 289 and following. The goal that we have is given a pseudorandom function, build a pseudorandom permutation. And the Feistel network is used in practice. So the data encryption standard DES, which hopefully is not used that much anymore, but it is based on the Feistel network. Interestingly, the Feistel network builds a permutation from any function. So how does it look? So we have an input value x, and we split this input value into two halves, into L0 and R0. And now we have a pseudorandom function f on key k1. And we input to this pseudorandom function the right part, the right half, as input. The left input side is then XORed with the output of the pseudorandom function. And then we repeat this process. We just switch the two outputs, so L0 XOR, the output of the pseudorandom function, becomes now R1, and R0 becomes L0. And we just continue this process now 4 times. Each time with a different key. And the final output is then L4 R4 which is output Y.
One question is,
yes.
This just a bitwise split?
Mm-hmm.
You just separate the binary front half?
Yes. Front half, second half, first half, second half. Yes. Yes, please. No.
Just for example.
This is one example, and you will see why I chose this example in a couple of seconds. I can tell you DES, and I will write this down also in a second. DES, so the data encryption standard, has 16 rounds. But 4 rounds with a strong pseudorandom permutation is sufficient. Or 4 is strong pseudorandom permutation is sufficient. if you use a PRF as the building block. Now, does anybody have an idea how to invert this function, how to invert this Feissl network? Yeah. No.
No.
That's the interesting part. So you really just go up the network again, and you feed the left part again, the fourth left part into the input of the pseudorandom function x, or the output with the fourth right half, and repeat this process over and over again until you reach the top again. Now, three rounds with pseudorandom function fk implies a pseudorandom permutation. Intuitively, you can think of the following. The first round yields that L1 looks random. But there is some homomorphism. So we have the XOR. If we XOR L0 to a random string, then of course the string looks random. But if we would evaluate L0, a different L0 but the same R0, then the XOR of those two will basically be the output of the pseudorandom function. So the XOR of L0 and the output, and the XOR of another L0 and the XOR of the output will yield just the output of the pseudorandom function of the first round. The second round lets L2 look random. And the third round lets L3 look random, even for x1 equals L0 concatenated with R0 and x2 is L0 prime concatenated with R0. So now we know how to build a pseudorandom permutation. The proof idea, and this is just a sketch, proceeds in a sequence of games. In the first step, we replace the first pseudorandom function with a truly random function. In the second game, we replace the second pseudorandom function with a truly random function. In the third game, we do the same for the third pseudorandom function. And now, as we see here, we have four pseudorandom functions involved. And the reason for that is that we actually need four rounds with a pseudorandom function fk to come up with a strong PRP, a strong pseudorandom permutation. And if you want to understand what the attack on three rounds Feistel network is, just take a look at the Luby-Rakoff paper. I actually looked at it yesterday again. It's super easy to read at the end, but we don't have the time to go in the details today. So, another comment that I already mentioned is that 16 rounds is what the data encryption standard has been using. The problem of the data encryption standard is, however, not that it uses the Feistel network, but that it uses 65-bit long keys. And just with a stupid brute force attack, this only takes 2 to the 56 steps for breaking the scheme at most. So, just as a quick formal notation, instead of having just this sketch of the scheme, L1 is set to R0, and R1 is set to L0 x or pseudorandom function of K1 and R0. And this continues until, in this case, L4, which is set to R3, and R4 being L3 x or f of k4 comma r3. All right, are there any questions about the Feistel network? So we have seen it has been super practically relevant because when DES was the only real encryption standard, this was the default. Today we use the advanced encryption standard, AES, and we will see in a second that this is slightly different and doesn't have these cool provable security guarantees. But we have also seen now, at least I told you so and you can trust me, that there is a proof that this Feistel network with four rounds suffices if you have a pseudorandom function to build a strong pseudorandom permutation. Why do we want strong pseudorandom permutations? Why aren't we happy with just a normal pseudorandom permutation? Maybe first, what was the difference again between strong and normal pseudorandom? Yes, please. Okay, yeah, this is a philosophical answer. Not bad. Practical answer? Yeah, also okay. It's a bit raw. Why do we want to give an attacker not only access to a challenge oracle in one direction, but also in the other direction? Maybe a quick reminder, a different word for a pseudorandom permutation, especially strong pseudorandom permutation, is a block cipher. So what do we do with block ciphers and why does it make sense to allow an attacker to challenge that thing in both directions? Quickly, everybody wake up. This is not a technical question. This is about the meaning. Why are we doing this? Why can't we just save one round in the Feistel network? Maybe pseudorandom permutations are enough. Why do we want to have strong pseudorandom permutations? Yes, please.
Maybe a simple answer, but we just don't want the adversary to be able to inverse our encryption simply.
Yes.
So the adversary should not be able to convert the ciphertext back into the plain text easily.
That is, so by Kerckhoff's principle, we tell the attacker how our Feistel network works, and we tell the attacker which pseudorandom function we use. So this is given to the attacker. We also give the attacker challenges. So we give the attacker the ability to choose arbitrary x's and then see either random or real y's. But why do we give the attacker also the option to invert our pseudorandom permutation? This is a block cipher. It's about encryption. So we can consider our X's as messages and our Y's as ciphertexts. Why do we want to give the attacker the ability not only to select messages and see real or random ciphertexts, but also giving the attacker an oracle in which the attacker can input outputs of our PRP. Which means selecting arbitrary ciphertexts and sending them to the attacker, to the victim. What is, yeah, please.
Yeah, it's about, I think it's about chosen ciphertext attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So we want protection against that as well, not only, I don't know, protection against an eavesdropper or something like that.
Exactly. So we are in a situation, this is like very, very realistic, that an attacker can send something to victims and observe their behavior. So the attacker can just craft ciphertext, the attacker can manipulate ciphertext, the attacker can just do with ciphertext whatever they want to, and then send that to the victims and possibly observe how they react to that. And the strongest reaction that we can observe is seeing the full plaintext. There are weaker forms of that. For example, I think I motivated this 2 weeks ago with Instagram or something. So I can, as Instagram, send a message or a ciphertext to Bob in the name of Alice that is just a garbage ciphertext. And then Bob may just post something on Instagram saying that, oh, I just received something from Alice. This looks like that garbage. And suddenly Instagram sees what the message in that ciphertext would have been. And we can escalate that to all types of communication systems that are encrypted, and Instagram is not encrypted. But WhatsApp, Signal, and so on, all of those allow an attacker to change ciphertexts, and possibly there are some threat vectors, some means with which the attacker can observe the reaction. And those here are the smallest building blocks that we use for encryption. And for that reason, thinking in both directions, if either this is just used as encryption, which is not the case, it's always used in a construction, but also if we later want to build a reduction from a larger type of encryption that uses this building block, then this larger type of encryption will allow an attacker to query chosen ciphertexts. And then we have to simulate that. And the only way typically we can simulate that is using such oracles from the underlying building blocks. Okay, I just said that alternative B to Feistl networks is so-called substitution permutation networks. Substitution permutation. And the only reason why I write that down is that you have it in mind in case you want to take a look deeper into that, because it is important, as it is the basis for the Advanced Encryption Standard, AES, but there is not much to say about that from a cryptographic perspective, because it is, first of all, slightly more complicated. But more importantly, it is based on heuristic cryptanalytic arguments. What I mean by that is that, and I put these heuristics in quotation marks because I don't want to say that what cryptanalysts do is not valuable. This is super valuable what they do. But there is no proof. There is no reduction that tells us that these substitution permutation networks are based on some smaller building blocks that give us some guarantees. So the Feistl network directly relates the security, or its security as a strong pseudorandom permutation, to an underlying pseudorandom function. We don't have this guarantee, we don't have this type of argument for substitution permutation networks. If you are interested in that, take a look at that at home, but I don't have much to say about a cryptographic proof perspective on that. Yes, please. Yes, so it depends on what type of pseudorandom functions you're looking at, but GGM is an example that you can build a pseudorandom function from a pseudorandom generator.
That relates the problem
to a pseudorandom generator, and the pseudorandom generator can be built from theoretic arguments, or with very theoretic arguments from one-way functions, And one-way functions are the most fundamental building block for which we don't have any clue how to build them provably secure. So these are typically our lowest level assumptions, and we can't go lower than that.
Okay, so we always end up at one of these heuristic assumptions.
Somewhere, yeah.
Potentially at a spot that feels more comfortable to trust
them. Exactly, okay. Exactly. And I think I feel very comfortable with using AES. If there is a very fishy one-way function, and also I think the construction of pseudorandom generators from one-way functions is just a very theoretical. I believe that it's probably not very practical. It's just a proof that complexity theoretically, one can relate these things and build them on top of each other. And the only reason that I give those things here or I present those things to you is to tell you that there are much more fundamental small building blocks that we can relate those things to, but if you want to build a secure encryption scheme, then it's probably better to just use AES because it is very well tested. Hundreds of cryptanalysts looked at that, and I believe that if you would like to build a strong PRP from the Feistel network, from a pseudorandom function, then you will also end up in a pseudorandom function that is not based on a pseudorandom generator via GGM, but rather also on cryptanalyst arguments. My perspective is here just we can build a ladder, and there are steps on this ladder, and there are actually provable like reductions or relations. Okay, speaking about theory, second part of our lecture today is weak encryption. Or theoretic encryption. The first encryption scheme that I want to present you, because it's necessary to tell you about this at one point in a fundamental cryptographic lecture, is the one-time pad. The condition for the one-time pad to work is that the key space equals the message space, and this also equals the ciphertext space, which we just denote here as the string of length L, or all strings of length L, where L is a natural number. The gen algorithm of this encryption scheme just samples a random key element and returns this key. The encryption algorithm on input of some k and some m is just defined as the XOR sum of those two. And the decryption algorithm is just the same. To see that this scheme is correct, we just can see that the decryption under K of the encryption under K of a message is K XOR M XOR K, which is M. Yay, happy. Security. So we can ask, what type of security requirements that we have seen is achieved? So We have to find one-way CCA security. And is this scheme one-way CCA secure? In the sense that we defined it 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. A reminder is that one-way CCA security means that the challenge is, or does anybody remember what one-way CCA security is? One-way CCA security means that the challenge is a one-way challenge. That means that the message is sampled randomly, uniformly at random. And the attacker sees the challenge ciphertext, which is just the encryption of this random message. And then the attacker, based on CCA security, has access to a decryption oracle. So the adversary can just decrypt arbitrary ciphertexts. And the question is, can an attacker break the one-time bit? Yes, please.
They can, because given a ciphertext and message pair, the XOR is the key which is used to decipher the challenge key.
Okay, so first step is that the attacker sees a challenge ciphertext. The second step is then what?
Mm-hmm. Queries the CCA oracle to get the corresponding message text.
Mm-hmm.
Computes the XOR to get the key.
Mm-hmm.
And then computes the XOR on the challenge ciphertext to get the challenge message, and that's the result.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Is there a more efficient way of doing that? Is there a way to directly get the key? Just with the decryption oracle? Yes.
Well, the trivial attack, but that shouldn't be permitted, right?
Yes, I'm not allowed to query C star. That is true. Is there another way to just get the key as output of the decryption oracle? So I just write down that I want to have that, and you can tell me what the input is. Mm-hmm. So it's not one-way CCA secure in the sense that we defined it, but is it one-way CPA secure? One-way CPA secure means the attacker does not have a decryption oracle, but it does have an encryption oracle. Mm-hmm. Right, you can do just the same. The one-time pad is not pointless. If I use one key per message, then the one-time pad is perfectly secure and unconditionally secure. And it has actually been used, as far as we know, in practice. It has been used during Cold War for communication between White House and Kremlin. But the downside is obvious. We need long keys for long messages. And we need some form of out of band key distribution. That's everything that I wanted to tell you about the one-time pad. If you want to take a look at the security proof that shows that it is perfectly and unconditionally secure, you can take a look at the book on page 31. I think there is very little insight to that. Other cryptographers might disagree with me, but I think it's not super useful. So this brings me to the second rather theoretical construction, which is a PRG-based encryption. Here we have that message and ciphertext space are identical. But we can have a key space that is shorter than that.
One question.
Mm-hmm. M equals C, this is a calligraphic C, I'm sorry.
It's not identical to the vowel to the L. That's two different.
Yes, the upper part is an L, the lower part is a C. So we have a message and ciphertext space that is the strings, all strings of length L, and we have a key space that is all strings of length L prime, where L is larger than L prime, and L prime are natural numbers. The KeyGen algorithm just samples a random key from the key space and returns that key. The encryption algorithm on input of the key and the message is the same as the decryption algorithm that on input key and ciphertext just outputs the message, respectively the ciphertext, XORed with the pseudorandom generator, evaluated on the input key K. For this, we can just build a simple reduction, and there is a very simple trade-off. So we trade the key length with assumptions. Yes?
The second last line means.
Yeah, the second input.
C, where is the C on the right side?
So in this case, we have the assumption, or we have the condition, that we have a secure PRG. Otherwise, we have the same problems as the one-time PET. Which now brings me to real practical encryption schemes. Pseudorandom function-based stream ciphers. The construction of a stream cipher has the advantage that we have a key space with bounded length. And a message space of arbitrary length. The intuition is super simple. We have our pseudorandom function f with key k. And we have our messages m. And we just XOR these messages to the output of the pseudorandom function. So M1 is XORed with the output of the pseudorandom function, and the input to the pseudorandom function is just some initialization vector concatenated with a counter. The output is then the first ciphertext, and we repeat this just with the initialization vector and the second value input to the pseudorandom function. We XOR the result with our second message. And we continue to do so until we encrypted all blocks or all bits.
What do you mean with the concatenated 2, 3, and so on?
Yes.
In the first line,
yes.
The initialization vector concatenated
with 1, 2, 3, it's a counter.
Yeah, but what representation?
We go there in a second. This is just a sketch. This is an informal sketch. We have to live with some room for interpretation for now. So, our gen algorithm is just the same as for the pseudorandom generator based construction. So we just sample a fresh key and we return that key. Now our encryption on input of a key and a message. Samples initialization vector of length L prime. And then we set our I to 1. And of course, we need some encoding. So that is clear, that is true, that is a good observation. And then we encrypt the message until we have no message left. So we evaluate our pseudorandom function on the initialization vector concatenated with our counter. And there are different ways of doing the encoding here. So I could, for example, just be of a fixed length, and maybe our stream cipher just has a bounded length or a bounded number of invocations that we can use. So for example, we could just bound our message space to the number of encodings of the pseudorandom function here, or for the inputs of this pseudorandom function. So encoding must be unique. For all initialization vectors concatenated with an I. And then we split our message. Into a first part and this first part just shrinks with no. This first part is the part that we will now encrypt. So it is the first m bits. Wait a second. Let me think for a second. So this first part is either as long as the output of the pseudorandom function, or at some point it might be shorter than the output of the pseudorandom function because we entered the last block that we want to encrypt. The second part is then just the rest of it. And it might be empty at the end when we consumed the entire message and encrypted it. The ciphertext is the concatenation of the previous version of the ciphertext, and we didn't initialize it, so let's just write that the ciphertext at the beginning is the empty string. With the message m prime XORed with the output of the pseudorandom function that is reduced to the number of bits of that particular message. Then we increment our counter, and at the end we return the initialization vector of the fixed length together with the ciphertext. The decryption just works the same, except that we don't sample. Oh, this here should be sampling. Except that we don't sample a fresh initialization vector, but the initialization vector is already provided as part of the ciphertext. So we just basically chop the initialization vector, take it, and use it as the input to the pseudorandom function. And then we just do the XOR again, which gives us our message. So correctness is pretty straightforward. Security we have INDCPA security if the pseudorandom function is INDPRF secure. This is basically the idea of the so-called counter mode. And this particular stream cipher idea is parallelizable. And this does not hold for all stream ciphers. One well-known instantiation of the pseudorandom function for that particular idea here is the SALSA 20 and ChaCha variant. So well-known instantiations. SALSA. And ChaCha. That are specified in RFC 7539. Yes. Counter mode. We will now go to block modes of operation. And while this is the idea of a stream cipher, if FK is basically considered a block cipher, this is just the counter mode. Okay, log cipher modes of operations. So a block cipher can be considered a strong pseudorandom permutation and the idea of these modes of operation is that we combine block ciphers for encryption of long messages. So just quickly a reminder, we have seen this today before. A block cipher takes as input a message, is internally keyed, and outputs a ciphertext. And we have also the inverse operation that takes a ciphertext and produces back the message. And in contrast to that, we have pseudorandom functions that take as input some value x and produce as output some value y. And of course, and this is an obvious implication, if fk is a strong PRP, then of course FK is also a PRF. So the first counterexample to talk about block ciphers is the electronic codebook mode. ECB. And important to note is that one should not use. The reason for that is this funny TUX image that I guess most of you have seen before. So what's the interpretation of that image? Yes, please.
I think it is if you encrypt every single block by its own, then you can detect patterns in the resulting ciphertext.
Especially if you use the same function and the same key every time. So the left image is this funny Linux penguin. In the middle, we have an ECB encryption of this image. And on the right side, we have some proper encryption that does not leak any patterns about what has been encrypted. And the sad part is that once per year, or maybe twice, once every 2 years, we still see examples of real-world protocols that use ECB. So The idea of ECB is that message one is encrypted to ciphertext one by just using a PRP, or a strong PRP in that case, because an attacker may want to query the inverse. Same happens with message M2 and so on. And we have just heard the problem of that, which is that if we encrypt the same message multiple times, we see always the same ciphertext. So whenever we encrypt a white pixel, we will see that there is some purple pixel as the result of the encryption. And seemingly this is not the same white as this white, so this outer white here is encrypted to some gray pixel. And this is just, of course, an image interpretation of the output bits, but you see what the problem is. You can see patterns. And patterns for this TUX image is not problematic, but you will see these same patterns if you have longer or whatever types of encrypted information, if it is text or whatever. And we have heard about the CISA cipher at the very beginning of this course. This is just a more advanced idea of the CISA cipher. The second mode of operation is much more important because it is used widely all over the internet. The cipher block chaining mode. CBC. So for example, in the signal standard or in the document that specifies how the double redshift algorithm works and how it should be used, you see that they recommend the use of AES CBC for encryption, but with a message authentication code to make sure that everything is fine. So the idea of the CBC mode is that we again use a PRP. And the input to this PRP is not only the message, but the XOR of that message, at least at the initial first encryption of message M1, with the initialization vector. The result is the first ciphertext C1. And now message 2 is XORed with the ciphertext C1, so with the first output of the first encryption of the first message block. And we continue to do so, so we always chain the ciphertext to the next invocation. And obtain the ciphertexts. This is the idea. As I just said, it is widely used. It is secure. it offers IND CPA security. If the PRP is IND secure, but it has also been the target of multiple attacks. But these attacks don't target the IND CPA security, but rather the IND CCA security. So an attacker is capable of changing, manipulating, producing own ciphertexts. And the problem is that CBC sometimes is not protected against CCA secure, against chosen ciphertext attacks. And sometimes the measures for making it secure against chosen ciphertext attacks were insufficient. And in both of these cases, CBC offers some interesting forms of allowing for interesting attacks. So one problem that might be caused by in the context of using CBC is that the padding can be manipulated in a way such that we have so-called CBC padding oracle attacks. These attacks have been discovered by Serge Vodanyi and published at Eurocrypt 2002. And the underlying problem of these padding oracle attacks is that ciphertexts of CBC are malleable. Due to the XOR operation. And this is somewhat related to the chaining of the encryption from ciphertexts that influence the next input messages. Another obvious point here is that it is not parallelizable. The basic idea of these attacks that I just briefly sketch or mention here is that when an attacker produces a ciphertext that is based on a real ciphertext and just, for example, changes the first ciphertext here slightly, then the decryption will take, first of all, the ciphertext C2 for decryption. It inputs that to the PRP, which is inverted. And then, in order to get the original message back, the output of the inversion of the PRP will be XORed with the ciphertext C1. Now, if the attacker only cleverly changes C1, it can directly manipulate the message bits of message M2. And the idea of the padding oracle attacks is that one could, for example, just chop off the end of the ciphertext and then change previous messages to look like the padding. So for example, C1, so if I know what message M2 looks like, I can just change the ciphertext C1 such that this message here looks like a real padding. So for example, if the padding is just the number of message blocks, then I can change the ciphertext here if I know what M2 looks like, to let M2 look like the padding instead. And one problem could be, if this entire ciphertext here is authenticated, for example, with the message authentication code, but I first do the decryption and then I do the verification of the message authentication code, and I decrypt until I find the padding and I am happy and I stop that, and then I only do the MAC verification, and there is a timing difference between ending the decryption and then checking the MAC verification, then I have a timing side channel, basically. And those type of side channels have been used, or those type of padding manipulations have been used to attack CBC. Yes, please.
What do you mean with padding? Filling with zeros or something?
Filling with something. Typically, CBC is, or CBC is used with different types of padding, but one way of padding could be that I just have, I don't know, let's say the message is three blocks, then I have 3 times 3 in a row, and this indicates that this is the padding and this is the end of the message. So if I had 3 blocks and I see that the last message ends with three blocks of three, then I'm happy and this is the padding. There are different forms of padding, but this is just a way of filling the messages such that I have something to encrypt with the full block length.
It's just a filling pattern.
No, yes, exactly.
And the filling doesn't have a meaning, but this non-meaning is the weak spot
here. Exactly, yeah. If I know the padding, I can create the padding somewhere else and so on. Yeah, just a quick note. And the final note that I want to make here, just as an advertisement for next week, always use authenticated encryption. And this will be the core of next week. Thank you very much for your attention. See you next week.